What a lovely tone to start with. So, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Again.
So this is...
Say hello.
This is module 10, entitled The Development of Ego. And this is talk one, which is an introduction. And I would like to begin by once again reciting the four dharmas of Gampopa, because that's an outline of the very first part of this talk. So everyone has that. Let's do that together. Grant your blessing
so that my mind may be one with the dharma. Grant your blessing so that dharma may progress along the path. Grant your blessings so that the path may clarify confusion. Grant your blessings so that confusion may dawn as wisdom.
So the Buddhist path, in the most general sense, is a journey from confusion to wisdom. And we undertake this journey so that our lives can be joyful and uplifted, free from fear and anxiety, and so that we may radiate this to everyone we encounter. So that's a pretty lofty goal, and we have to get down to some nitty-gritty. In order to do this, to start on this journey, we need to put three things together. One of them is meditation. A second one is how we approach our study. And the third one is how we bring this into our daily life. So those are like three pillars of how we progress along the path. When we meditate, the meditation can become either wild and excited, or it could become rather dull and habitual. And one of the things we can do with our study is to see how the study can enhance our meditation practice. And the other goes too, that is, without meditation, we don't get much out of the study. It takes actually being able to settle our mind and learn to stay in our seat, in our chair or cushion or whatever, in order to actually hear the teachings with an open enough mind and engage the depth of our mind fully in order to make progress there. And the third component is a willingness to take what we get from our meditation and our practice and take it very personally, and bring it into all the hidden corners of our life so that there's nothing that's a total vacation from being a Dharma practitioner. That sounds frightening when people begin, and if it sounds frightening, then just leave it alone and try to remember that it was said, even if it sounds like it's an invasion of your privacy, that whatever you do, whether it's at work, driving a car, making love, arguing with your boss, going to sleep, Dharma really can pervade and start to make all the parts of our life more brilliant when we give into it. So there are those three components. This talk is really a very brief introduction to two modules. This one, module 10, which is called The Development of Ego, and the next one, which will probably start in January, which is called karma. And as we teachers started to wrestle with how we were going to do this, we saw that we needed to give it two modules, one for the development of ego and the other for karma. So I want to talk very briefly about both of them tonight, which means we have to go at a good clip. So the teachings we're doing now are really very basic, more basic than things we thought, like Tonglin and the four immeasurables and so on. We're going right back to the very foundational teachings. Both of these topics, the development of ego and karma, are truly foundational, and they're found in some of the earliest of Buddhist scriptures that we know of. They're found in a very early text called the Abhidharma, which probably dates from around 100 BC. So, basically, we start with we want to be free from suffering. I think that's where we all start from. And as we get into it, we see that there's more to it. We want everyone else to be free from suffering. And we find that, so basically, we all want to be free from samsara. The definition of samsara is that it's endless cycling of suffering. That is, it's not just suffering, it's suffering which, because we approach it the wrong way, leads to further suffering. So samsara is always defined as an endless cycle. And we would like to be free from it. All of us, I'm pretty sure.
What does that mean, the wrong way? Like approaching it from the wrong way?
We're going to have to get into that in depth, yes. Wrong way because if it hurts and we strike out at something because it hurts, or it hurts and we retreat into our bed because it hurts, that may not be the best way to deal with the fact that it hurts, for example. So samsara generally involves a approaching pain from the point of view of not facing it, of running away from it, one way or the other, hurting ourselves, hurting someone else, ignoring it. Those are all ways that perpetuate suffering. So that's a very good thing to point out. So it turns out that we can't get rid of suffering by taking a sudden leap and saying, I'm free. I'm going to jump out of it. And we can't get out of it by wishing it or deluding ourselves into thinking that we're not suffering anymore. The situation we find ourselves in is just doesn't go away that easily. And the first thing we have to do is to get to know where we are at. So until we know we are at where we are at, we can't go and make further progress acting as if we've jumped out of samsara and we're no longer there. We have to get to know samsara. And that's what both of these courses are about. How do we actually get to know samsara, and how does it work? In our tradition, we always start with meditation. We don't like to do teaching without it. So that's why we always have meditation before teaching, and we encourage people to have a practice. Once we are able to sit, not to become great enlightened Buddhists, but just to sit and not jump up and run away, then questions come up in our mind. And they're likely to be of two types. The first one is, what's happening right now? As I'm sitting or as I'm driving my car, what is my mind really doing right now? And the second type of question is, how did this all come about? How did I get here? And where am I going? These are two slightly different questions. And this first course, the development of ego, is about the first question, what's happening right now? And the second class that we will be dealing with, karma, is how did this come about, and what's happening in the future? What is our path in a larger sense? I want to say that these two questions come up no matter where we are. It's by no means unique to Buddhism, for example. In Dante's Divine Comedy, he begins right in the very first stanza by saying, "I awoke in a dark forest." And because the direct path had become lost, I had lost my bearings. So Dante had to deal, first of all, with his immediate surroundings. In this dark forest, in fact, he was very frightened of it, and he had to deal with that first, which is the first question, what's happening right now? And then he had to deal with what kind of a journey I am on, which is the second question. However, as Buddhists, our journey is going to be quite different than Dante's, because we have no theology. So we can't have any reliance on God or on gods in a sense of many gods or some ultimate first cause, which is where everything comes from. We can't rely on a historical explanation. This is the story of how things happened and Adam and Eve and all that. We don't have any basic creation myth. And we don't even have any fixed teaching, in a sense, fixed belief, that is. Whatever we teach is provisional, and we have to see beyond anything, because we can't even fixate on any ideas we have. We can use them, ideas are important, but we always have to be willing to go beyond them. So, this is the first of three points I want to make. That is this one, then I want to talk about the development of ego, then I want to talk very briefly about karma. But I want to stop here for a moment. I want to ask you, can you recapitulate sort of what I just said, using the four dharmas as a guide? Look at the four dharmas. You have linked words. You have...
We don't have the four dharmas. We have the five skandhas.
Oh, we didn't hand that out, did we? I'm sorry about that.
But they mostly know it, I think.
Okay, so grant your blessings. Mind, they're linked words. Mind, dharma. Dharma, path. Path, confusion. Confusion, wisdom. And there's some helping words. Mind may be one with dharma. Dharma may progress along the path. The path may
clarify
confusion. Confusion may
dawn
as wisdom. Does what I just said make sense in terms of that? That this is just the first of many levels of understanding of the four dharmas, which we use so often. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the dawn of wisdom, would that include a purpose in life?
Is it something you can put in words?
Yeah, intentionality of, like you said, there's no attachment to the notion of first cause or God. So a lot of people would ask, well, what's the purpose of life?
Okay. So the last one, that confusion may dawn as wisdom, has to be beyond concept. In other words, if you can say it in words, that's not it. Earlier, you can say things in words, okay? That is, my mind may be one with the Dharma. That means I can start to think about important Dharma ideas and let my mind go along this path, the Dharma path, rather than something else? And then what's the next part? Dharma means...
To what? To my question or to the Agampopa's statements?
Okay, Dharma may...
To Gampopa's statements, he's asking.
Yeah. What about...
Yeah, well, the Dharma one. Wisdom, what would wisdom include in terms of what I asked, the intentionality?
It probably means going beyond intentionality. That's why it comes at the end.
Although there is a discussion of wisdom as being fundamental intentionality. That there is a fundamental sense of... intent, enlightened, what we call enlightened intent, that fundamentally, and this goes back to what we've been discussing at the beginning, which is Buddha nature, is fundamentally Buddha nature is enlightened. Our intrinsic nature is enlightened. So when we get to that point of where confusion dawns as wisdom, that fundamental wisdom mind emerges into our life in clarity. And so that's a state of realization. Okay. It's sort of after you've gone through your intent, your personal intent.
Yeah, so if I could rephrase it then, it would, instead of saying there's a purpose of afterlife, one could say the fullness of one's own life.
The fullness of one's own life will do, yes. But the fullness of one's own life basically doesn't involve that I have this plan I'm following, or this is how I'm going to make it work. In other words, it has to be beyond that. There's much greater spontaneity as we move along. But yes, it does get internalized, and we have that wisdom within us, and we want it to shine.
I was actually listening to a CD of Joseph Campbell talking about Eastern and Western stuff. And he said, you know, in the East, the major religions, belief systems, see that sort of what we're looking for, the goodness or what runs the earth, really is inside of us, and we just need to become aware of it. So, but what we're going to become aware of isn't anything you can put into words. And that's very much, you said, sort of when you look at Eastern religion. So the Western religion, we have, there's God, you can't even know God. You can kind of know the Son of God if you're very lucky. But God isn't in you. Like, what makes the universe so amazing isn't inside of you. So it's, he was saying, sort of like, it's a very different view than the one most of us grew up with, which is, there's this God, you know, and you can believe or not believe now, but that's kind of maybe what you're taught, that something out there is giving the sense of what to do, and this is this, like, not at all the same idea, but it's, there's something in there.
Until we
reveal it, but it's, and you can't, no one can tell you, like, oh, if you just think about what you want to do with your life, then that will come out, like, it's not.
No. But we are going beyond thinking we know this. What that our idea of what's inside and what's outside has to be given up too.
Right.
We think this is me and that's outside, and we have to go beyond that too. Mm-hmm. So we have much less fixed posts and more intimate, work.
Go ahead, finish your sentence.
What?
Finish your sentence.
I don't know that I need to. You have something you want to say, I think.
Well,
don't you?
I think to me, I mean, the loss of people going to church. There's very few people going to church. You have huge churches with very few people in them. So religion has not been successful, or it's not successful now because there's so, you know, I don't know why exactly, but my opinion is there's so much in the outside world that pulls people away. But at the same time, church failed, regular traditional churches failed people.
Yeah, we're living in a time when the churches have much less power than they did in the past. That's certainly true. That is, society is very, at this point, focused on material issues.
You're speaking more about this Western...
Well, at least in our country.
In our country.
Yeah, yeah. I actually would say that their church is still pretty strong in other parts of the country, not
necessarily yeah.
Yeah. The East. So
right, the South is very strong.
In the West, Midwest.
In the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
That's
true.
So I wonder why that is.
Well...
Well, that isn't related to this, but...
I don't know. To go there takes us away from what we're doing into a whole bunch of history and sociology and psychology and everything you want to. We could go on forever. And there would be interesting conversation, but I don't think we can go there now.
Okay.
And I don't think anyone can put it into one sentence.
Well, someone could. It just doesn't have to be true.
Well, okay.
Literacy by Stephen Prothero, which was talking about the fact that America is one of the most religious nations in the world, but also one of the least informed about the principles of their religion. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting tour of the changing Christian, primarily Christian faith.
So I'm going to go on.
Okay.
But the aspect of journey is important, and by the way, this talk written out as a whole essay is online, although it won't be enriched by a lot of things people have said here. So this course now is called The Development of Ego, and we're going into the most basic Buddhist teaching there is, which is called, the most basic teaching, what do we have in one word?
Dharma.
What?
Dharma.
Well, the Dharma is the name we give to the teaching. Non-self. Every religion talks about suffering, every communist state talks about suffering, but non-self is the most fundamental thing that Buddhism has to something to say about. So we're told a lot of things which are difficult to swallow. One of them is we're told that the self is an illusion, that what we think of as myself is an illusion. We're told that in our classes again and again and again. We don't buy it, but we're told that. And then the other thing we're told is that the self is the basis for our unhappiness, for our difficulty in actually relaxing and being here. So first of all, it doesn't exist. Secondly, it's responsible for a lot of problems. That sounds like a paradox, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. So it's hard to accept, because no matter how much we hear all this, basically what do we think? Well, it's happening to me. How can you say there's no self when all sorts of things are happening to me? Things I like, accidents, growing old, having a birthday party, all sorts of things are happening to me. How can you say this me doesn't even exist? And the Buddhist answer is going to be, yes, lots and lots of things are happening. All those things are happening. The only thing that's missing is someone who owns the experience. And when we strive, and we can strive very energetically, to find out who owns the experience, if we say, this experience is happening to me, where is that me which is the owner of the experience? And if we actually get critical and energetic enough in our investigation, we don't find it. And that's what this whole course, The Development of Ego, is about. The owner is missing. And we aren't going to settle this tonight, but we're going to approach what the course is going to be about. Lists are always a traditional way of memorizing teachings and of outlining teachings. And there's one important list for this course, and it's called the five skandhas. You have a little piece of paper which lists all five of them up. This teaching goes back over 2,000 years, and the five skandhas are form, feeling, perception, impulse, formation, sometimes called concept, sometimes intellect in this book, but that's unusual. Even Trungpa Rinpoche, who wrote this book, hasn't used the term intelligence consistently. I think formation's a better name. And the fifth one is always called consciousness. For over 2,000 years, they've always been recited in this order: form, feeling, perception, impulse, concept, or formation, and consciousness. So our approach, and the approach of the book we're using for the course,
which is?
The book is Glimpses of Abhidharma by Chogyam Trungpa.
Let me interject here. This is a very, very old and out-of-print version of that book. I was supposed to have copies of the book here tonight, which unfortunately didn't arrive yet. We'll have them here next week. Of course, you're welcome to purchase these online. You may find them in a bookstore, but if you're interested in obtaining them from me, let me know. I have about 7 or 8 copies on order right now, but I can order more, and if you want to meet me after class, I'd be able to take your names down and just ensure that we'll have copies for you by next Wednesday, by next Thursday.
Thank you, Michael. It's a great help that you bring the books, and I'm sorry that the shipment was late. Certainly not anything you could do anything about. So,
Michael, can I ask you this? Not a bad question. Okay.
Yeah.
Like other people, I struggle with words like skandhas, so I know you've told us like 20 times, and I've managed to forget 21 times.
Yeah, okay.
Anything other than I know if there are 5 of them.
Yep, there are 5 of them.
Good starting place.
Good, okay. The word skandha means heap. That's the translation we use for skandha. Is that what you were asking?
Yeah, but then what does it mean?
What does it mean? We're going to have to take time to do that, okay?
Okay. So it's a negative connotation.
Is it a negative connotation that there are 5 skandhas? No.
No, not that there are 5. No, 5 is an okay
number. What was the definition here?
The definition is heap.
Heap.
Okay?
Heap. Pile.
Pile. Pile.
And, so, and even the name itself does not have a negative connotation.
Okay.
It's actually just a word that refers to either a bundle or a pile, but it refers to a complex, which we could say. I mean, as we explore these terms, you'll understand why this term came into being. It was a common term, I think, when the Buddha spoke it, because he spoke in a pre-literate age for most people.
Right.
And no one was writing anything down at the time he spoke.
So,
yeah.
The view we're going to take, however, is because we are Vajrayana students, we are students of Jogyam Trungpa, all 4 of us, as is Pema, for example, and we take a rather tantric view of that, as he does in this book, which is they're heaped on top of each other. That is, instead of just the 5 separate things, that's supposed to be, by the way, a catalog of everything you can experience. That's the intent of it. Anything you experience is supposed to come into one of those categories, which
okay,
is not going to be obvious at this point. But we take heaped on top means sequential. That is, any moment of consciousness comes about because there's form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness. And furthermore, the whole sequence takes an instant. And an instant is a time which is too short for the human mind to parse into separate steps. If we say bum 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 bum, you have no problem seeing that there's a sequence of notes and they're spaced maybe a quarter of a second apart, you can follow them. This sequence takes place faster than it's possible to perceive. And that is what that is the fundamental view being taken here. That a moment of self happens so fast that it's like one frame of a motion picture. And when we say that there's no self, what we mean is that there's no self that stays around for any amount of time. That the important thing here is that the self is born in an instant, and the next instant it's born again. So what we are continuously doing is reinventing ourselves every instant, many times even in 1 second. And because this is going so fast, like cinema, we think that there's continuity to the cinema, but in fact there isn't. What we're getting is a series of still frames, each one, but they're happening faster than our mind can separate them, so it looks like continuous motion.
Can you give an example of a ba-ba-ba-ba?
What?
Can you give an example?
How am I supposed
to do that? Down.
Yeah. Can we slow down the status? No.
Yeah, give an example of in a split second, blah 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 blah. So what are those? What are those steps? What are those visuals that you're
We're going to have to take several weeks to go through that.
Oh,
it happens like this, but she can't talk about it. That
we go through them form, feeling. We're going to take a week on each one, believe it or not.
Okay.
Yeah, it's more like. So
we shall see.
It's been said, if you could divide up a second into at least 300 parts, which would be very hard for our own mind to grasp, that you would get a sense of how this process works. But because, as Michael says, it's an instantaneous, for all intents and purposes, situation, which still has a sequence in itself. It's built on. This is a whole effort.
So we're experiencing all of these in a split second, in a flash frame experience
Or we're not experiencing it, okay? It's like it bubbles up from the primordial swamp down there, and this bubble comes up, and we aren't experiencing it until it hits the surface, which is the fifth one, consciousness. And then all of a sudden it bangs into us and it surprises us. Where did that thought come from?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
So can we go back through it? Probably not. He says no, that it's not a good approach. Yeah.
Could I say that if you say it happens in a flash, you know, in infinitesimal thing.
It's not
like
infinitesimal.
Like, how do you say it happens all at once?
Well,
so why do you have to? I can see you saying it happens in a sequence just so we can comprehend the complexity of what happens all at once.
Okay, so if we say it happens in no time at all, for one thing, you're kind of violating ordinary physical science, okay? If your brain is doing something or your mind is doing something, it actually takes time. There is time. It's not infinitesimal, but it's too short a time for awareness to tease it apart.
Time is a mental construct in science. Time does not exist. It's just a mental construct.
Okay, do you have a computer?
No, I don't.
I'm asking
yes,
you.
Yes, of course I do.
Yeah, okay. So I think your computer does 100 million multiplications in a second. Can you follow it as it does it?
No.
No, but it's still doing it, okay? It's not doing it in infinitesimal time.
Yes.
So there are things that can happen that are faster than our attention can comprehend.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's simple. I mean, it's your brain.
Yeah, okay.
Your brain runs like that.
Okay. We'll
It's your brain that runs.
That's...
As I'm looking at you, I'm thinking 4 zillion things all at the same time that are all connected.
Right.
And that's
Yeah.
I mean, it has.
Yeah, we're not saying something amazing or contradictory, okay? We're just saying that things can happen faster than we can be aware that they're happening.
Yeah.
I think that's why the movie, the still frame, is a good image, because we can all imagine different frames of a movie. But when you're sitting there watching a movie, I guess that's the old days when there was film, and now it's different. But
that's the same.
But, okay.
Video's no different.
Okay, video. What?
It has frames.
So, but when you're sitting there watching the movie, you're not thinking frame, frame, frame. It's like, oh my God, that guy's got a gun. He's going to shoot her right now. And your emotions rise up, and you're right there, and you feel like you're in the movie. That's what we're talking about.
Okay, that's a very useful transition, because the question is, why the hell would we want to study such a thing?
Right. Good.
Okay.
Roberta was wondering that.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. You keep coming back. It's a good time.
We're not self-conscious all the time.
We know that the actual invention of the computer is an externalization of mental processes.
Mm.
And so when, as Michael said, mentioned, you know, in what we call a second, there are 500 or more calculations, and, you know, all we see is the result sitting up on top. Okay, you know, if we had to really go back and take that apart, which is what we're doing here.
This is it.
Is we're actually taking it apart.
Right.
We're actually going to go into the wiring of how the mind works.
Right.
And the mind is working like this. This is what we've been able to find. And the reason we've been able to find that is because we've had people way, way for many thousands of years who have been studying the mind through the direct insight. And this is where this understanding arose. Mm-hmm. It arose through the Buddha himself arriving at this understanding through extraordinary insight. And it's something that we can validate with our own investigations. And so this is, I'm sort of buttressing this presentation a little bit to understand how it all works with what we actually have right now, the movie frame, the computers, perfect examples that we have to work with.
I think Roberta has a question.
Well, just, you know, part of me goes like, says who? You know,
okay.
You know, it's just like, okay, I'm supposed to buy this. This is as good as.
No,
Adam
I don't
Eve,
think you should buy anything.
Good as what?
This is as good as Adam and Eve.
I'm not sure. I'm actually not sure what's being offered for sale yet. I'm waiting to get to the sales.
No, we're not offering anything for sale tonight. Okay, I'm not trying to convince anything that there's something, that there's a piece of truth here.
I mean, I guess if it's been studied. I mean, Michael Fagan had a good explanation. It's been studied for thousands of years. I'm like.
Okay, still over those thousands of years.
To that insight.
Yeah, it's just.
Still over those thousands of years, people have come up with all sorts of different ideas, like how many are there a second and so on. And we aren't going to come up with a scientific conclusion about that.
So
we're not going to be able to.
So the gist that I'm getting is that we're searching for the tools to dismantle the ego so that we can see it in slow motion and really catch ourselves as we're maneuvering in these things so that we can slow it down and stop the process or come to terms with the process. Or
if we can't slow it down, we can at least understand that it's happening and we can understand the nature of it, okay?
Yeah.
So the question now is not to sell you on a theory of how many times a second something's going on, because I can't. Why is this useful to do?
Good.
That's what I want to get to.
That's what Roberta is.
Having been a psychology major, the ego development, you know, course that everybody takes if you had psych, and ego is a Freudian word. I just wonder why it's called development of ego. Implies
I'm going to ask you that question in five minutes.
Pattern of how it develops, you know, from when you're a little baby, is that where you're going with this?
No.
And is the word ego?
No.
So it seems to me it's an examination of the nature of self. It's not really development of ego. Development of ego.
They're technical terms in two different
veins.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay. They confuse me.
clarity, yes, of course it confuses you.
For because clarity, somehow, the nature of self.
What we're trying to deal with. We're working on the definition of self, okay? And we are not looking for any piece of history like how did ego develop from when I was this old to this old to this old. That is not the type of investigation we're talking about. We're talking about what is happening right now. This whole course is about what is happening right now, not about how did I get here or what happened when I was 5 years old or anything of the sort.
Right. And also, we asked this before last year, I remember.
Yeah.
The word ego didn't exist with Buddha. What was the word that
Atman.
He used?
Atman.
Mm-hmm. Atman.
Atman. And the closest translation we can get now in this century is ego?
Soul. Soul, if you like.
Itself. Yeah. No, it translates
ego
itself.
Ego was a word in English before Freud. That's the other thing.
It was?
Yes.
Because it's...
It was?
Yeah. Ego comes from Latin.
Latin. I'm sorry, Latin.
Yeah. It's a Latin word. Did it really exist in English before Freud?
I believe so, but I'm sorry. We're going down the rabbit hole here.
Okay.
Ego for educated people was...
We're going to recite mantras for 10 minutes. Okay.
So
tension.
Not the. Okay, we don't.
Ego.
Is that the Buddhist pill?
The question is why? What do we want to get from this sort of investigation? Okay. And what we want to get is to see what our mind is doing right now, and to see that it actually has. Stages, it doesn't come from absolutely nowhere. If there's a thought, the thought has to be pulled together from some ingredients before we're even aware of it. And this is a schema that could help us do that. But however the schema, which is not what I want to talk about at the moment, we start out by looking for the self because the self seems... The idea that we have a self seems problematical. When we study this, what we see is that at every instant we are making up a story, and this story is about me and something else. This is what we can learn from this. And it could be me and what I want to ignore, or me and what I want to seduce, or me and what I'm envious about, or me and what I'm confused about, or me and what I want to kill, me what I want to make love to, me and something that is contemptuous beneath my dignity. Whatever it is, the skanda process is producing moments of me, and it's doing it at an extremely high rate. And that is what we need to find out about. We aren't going to learn how many times this thing is going per second. We have no instrument that could possibly do it. So, what we can come out of it is, first of all, we aren't going to be able to shut it down either. That's not possible. It's our way. We are, as humans, and probably as animals and so on, we keep doing that. What we can start to learn is to see the transparency of it, to not let it carry us away, to take away the ability of the continuous skanda process to make us chase without any awareness, like a dog that has to retrieve the ball, keep us from see that we don't have to get angry because that other person made me angry, or we don't. In other words, we're trying to make ourselves free, and freedom consists of not buying into the continuous me story, and that's what we're looking for. But you raised a very important point, And I have a question prepared for you.
I guess we knew it was coming.
So, if the reward for this effort, why we should do it, is that we start to free ourselves from the constant compulsion to reinvent ourselves continuously. In other words, not that we can stamp on it and shut it off, but that we can be free of it, free from continuously believing in it, and start to see through it, to make it more transparent, so that we can become relaxed and confident and not anxious, and eventually all the way down the path like a Buddha, not being carried away from it at all. Although that's a pretty far off goal.
Says you.
Okay, well, if you're already there, then
if you're already there,
that's wonderful.
No problem.
There's no problem whatsoever.
Open.
So my question is, I spent many years seeing a psychologist to help me develop my sense of self so that I could function in the world. Will practicing non-self make me dysfunctional? You going to buy that? Anyone going to buy that? Someone want to talk about that? It comes up all the time, yeah.
I have something I can actually relate very well to.
Yeah.
Prior to joining this group, I investigated with, you know, personal development type of coach, the different selves, and with the insight that I got from this group, I get glimpses of the non-self. I feel when you can manipulate and change your behavior by appeasing the ego in many different ways, you will change your behavior, but the suffering still is there.
Yeah.
And then when you have the insight, when you slow down, I don't know what these are exactly, but you've given us a lot of hints as to what's going on, that we've slowed it down. When you have the insight that there's no one there, I think you dissipate all of that, and it's not even necessary. It just, nothing is needed. You have all you need.
I think you've just given an answer to a question Mary asked a little while ago, which is what is it that we do inappropriately? And what we do inappropriately is, well, if things don't work out with this self, we just go invent another one. And I think that's what you're saying, that that's a futile, ultimately a futile thing. Okay, does anyone want to... I've heard this fear come up, though, namely... I put a lot of work into making myself functional, which is good. It's a very good thing to do. And we don't teach Dharma to psychotic people, by the way, which is good.
I through the years, I've certainly encountered artists in particular, creatives, who were terrified that they were going to become like too sane fundamentally to keep creating, as though the root or the genesis of all their creativity was sort of neurosis. Could be argued that there's a lot of creative work as a result of neurosis, and I frankly don't think that we run the risk of becoming completely unneurotic. So I suspect that there will continue to be a lot of basis for creativity from that point of view. But we just went through a whole series of classes on sort of expressing awakened mind through art, fundamentally through the creative process. So that answers that question that was raised that I've heard raised many times from
many people ask that.
Yeah.
And many people are afraid that if they give up craziness, they give up their creativity. Mm-hmm. And that's something those people have to struggle with. Yeah.
Actually, I'd like to build off something Erica said that I think is relevant for everyone in here too. It's regarding the functionality. the functionality, you don't, I think you just start to realize how empty your other pursuits are. I mean, in that way, it does break the functionality, but I think it breaks the functionality of something that was created. And is that making sense to anybody?
Yeah.
Okay.
And
that's it.
And the path of understanding this does raise fears. Okay. When we start to look at this, it definitely, when you get start to see the, when you actually start to see it, new levels of fear can come up, which is why we have meditation and groups and so on, instead of saying go off and try to do this individually. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why people feel so empty today, because they don't have much inside.
Mm-hmm.
They're always looking for something. They don't feel full. So they're looking for outside things.
And this culture also, the culture we live, we inhabit, is always saying, who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, you can do it better.
So, or that person does it better than you.
Yeah.
So there's always this sort of sense of, I've got to market myself. I've got to rejigger myself so that I'm...
Particularly
it has its own special flavor with women, that's for sure. But it's a very interesting... How do you function in this culture if you don't have a shtick that you're promoting? It can be terrifying, as Michael...
I know that, I'm in my mid-50s, and I've been finding that I don't think I have the concept of no self at any really deep level, but it's a useful abstract concept for just getting rid of some of the accumulated bits of past history. Like, finally ditch the box of college papers from 1980. I realized that, okay, and I used to be a lot of weight associated with that. Like, I used to be able to do math. I can't do this math anymore. It's like, oh, okay, there was a Sandra that could do math, and I'm not the same person. And so that... I remember feeling really ecstatic at how easy it was to get rid of that. When I just said, the idea that there's this continuous person and I have to explain any fluctuation in my powers.
Or the grief at letting that person, I could have been.
And it was sort of like, okay, this is something I could do once, I can't do now, and this is going in the recycle bin. It was just a really, really helpful formulation for me.
Is this going to be at all related to something I remember that we went over, where in the beginning, when we're born, we're part of everything, and then we think we're separate, and we get scared?
Well, that's again a piece of history, and this is not a study of history. This is what's happening.
I thought it was something we learned here.
She's talking about the eye. Like the grain of sand sticking my head in.
We aren't going to study that sort of thing in this course, okay? What we're going to study is, can we understand how our mind reinvents itself continuously every instant, and what price we pay in terms of the exertion and the exhaustion that causes us because of the weight and belief we put into that. So, we're working with the present, but when we work with the present, it does bring up, if we go far enough, it depends on how much we do and how much work. It doesn't depend on how much we read a book or something, but how much actual depth we go into this, it can bring up fear. So, in about 5 minutes, can I go on to the next one or no?
Did we do this more briefly in the past?
Yes.
Okay.
You're hearing something.
Yeah. Okay. You've heard it before.
Okay. You've heard it before.
And we were confused then, so we're coming back.
But that was a different Roberta.
That was
that was a different
If you go back to a year ago in September, And that was like mid-September, we started the series. If you go in there, there's actually something on the development of ego, which was copied. So we're recycling, as we said. We're going to keep cycle back. Yep. So it's another round.
Okay, good. The meditation book we read had a big section.
Yeah, we work with non-self, different sections. The skandhas. We've heard pieces of this. So this course is more a concentrated focus. So we're going another level deeper to really get, just to have another chance to try to understand it more. Because we don't want to know. So it takes a while.
So we'll study it.
So it takes a while to just be comfortable being uncomfortable and going deeper. That's where we're going.
Okay, so the next course is called karma. And of course, karma is something we all think about in some way or other. There are two common ways we might think about it. One is a rather materialistic thing, which is that we live in a fairly random universe. There are certain things that are predictable, maybe, like if I work hard, I'll be successful. And so I can achieve something. But then maybe not. Maybe I can't achieve much because my parents were so poor that I couldn't get the education I wanted to. Or maybe I'm on my way to realizing what I really want to, but some drunken idiot smashed up my car and left me crippled, and it totally busted up my plans. So we see ourselves in a universe of helplessness and random things happening. This is a materialistic view. And another extreme would be a religious preoccupation. That is, what did I do in the past that was so bad that this happened to me? Can I understand this? If I work hard and do all the good deeds, will I get a better life next time? So neither of these is particularly a helpful thing to do. And we're not going to analyze any of this, but that will be, the next course will be about karma, and there'll be another list, which I'm not going to recite now. I'm not. This list is about, of the skandhas, is what's happening now. The other list is called the 12 nidanas, and not going to listen today because it's not helpful to do it today. But if you've ever seen what we call the wheel of samsara, the wheel of life, on the outside, 12 situations, and they're about karma. And say, this leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to this, and it goes round, and it doesn't stop. As you go round, you're going, this produces this, produces this, produces this. And that's the wheel of karma going forward. And it can also be seen going backward. It works like a clock. This happened because of this. This happened because of this. That's happened because of this. So this is called the wheel of karma. A very cute concept, except that it's not simple. It's, for one thing, it can deal with all sorts of cycles, from how did this thought produce this thought, what's going on from my childhood up to the time I die, what's happening five lifetimes ago, how did geological things in the past happen, and where is the earth going. You can take this on any scale you want, and one of the hard things to understand is that we are told that the self cannot be reborn. Logically, it can't, because it doesn't exist except momentarily. So it's not the self that is undergoing karma, which itself is a hard thing to understand.
What's the karma of that?
No, it's the people from the group Helen Guy has the place. Five went out to practice.
Okay.
So.
What's the karma of that?
So one of the things we can get from this is that we live in a world of vast cause and effect, which is completely beyond our present memory and our present aware sensory perceptions. In other words, this is not going to be something that we can use our present mind to actually understand in any detail. In that way, it differs from the skandhas, because if we work on it, we can see how our mind works in the present moment. And that starts to unravel the universe beyond the present in remarkable ways. This gives us an appreciation of how vast the universe of cause and effect is. And there's going to be more to say about that. But I mentioned the reward for doing this course. The reward for the next one, at least a reward, is that if we actually can understand how much vastness there is to this, we can live our present life without complaint, without regret. In other words, we have no excuse for being here right now. We fully accept responsibility for being here right now. Or another way to say that is drive all blames into oneself, but there is no self. So what that means ultimately is that there's no blames. That when we can actually start to get glimpses of that, the fruition of that is that we actually see the world as something sacred. We can get glimpses of the sacredness of the world when we can give up complaint about why we're here and what we're doing. And there's a lot more to be said about karma than that, but I think I've heard this from two teachers, and we have some wonderful exercises, even if it's hard to understand. So that's off in the future. So I'm through unless someone feels like they want to say something.
Is there a section from the book that we should read that would set us up for the next unit?
The next, yes. This book is for this course. I'm pretty sure that the book we're going to use for the next one is the one called Karma by...
He means what's the reading for tomorrow, next week.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry,
the next week it should be the chapter on form.
Form, first chapter, right?
Yeah.
So you can guess what the second chapter is.
That was the thing.
We're basically going through this book in order. Yes?
Yeah. Oh.
So in case you didn't hear it, the reading for next week is in Glimpses of Abhidharma, the first chapter.
The second chapter.
The second chapter.
The first one would be an introduction.
Okay.
It's very brief.
Introduction and second chapter.
Chapter one. Comes after the introduction.
There you go.
Okay.
Doing my best.
Thank you.